It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farid. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A chef joins us to share secrets and techniques to make delicious and elegant dishes that are easier than they look. First, we're 1 week out from Black Friday, when retailers usually start some of their biggest sales of the year, and hundreds of people line up to crowd into stores and snag what's on their gift list. At least that was before 2020. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, things are looking a little different. Major retailers are making changes to both the in-person aspect of Black Friday shopping and the kinds of deals they're offering online and in stores. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you usually a big holiday Black Friday shopper? How are you changing your plans this year? Are you opting for some online shopping instead of heading to the store? Have you done some shopping earlier than usual, taking advantage of some of those early deals going on? Has this year forced you to cut back on spending? Maybe skip those purchases and wait until next year. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Hart Posen is a professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business. Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
Well, Hart, in a normal year, I know 1 week out from Black Friday, you'd usually be calling in from a department store parking lot. You'd have your tent, a week's worth of rations. You'd be first in line for the big deals. Not happening this year?
It's not happening for most of us this year, that's for sure. You know, this year, Black Friday and the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas is going to be very, very different.
And a lot of stores, Hart, I understand, have started Black Friday early, even as early as October with some of their sales, right? What's going on?
Well, you know, it became very apparent by the time fall started, or even in summer, that there was no chance that the holiday season in 2020 was going to look like it did in 2019. So many, almost all the big retailers had started planning for this change, really struggling to figure out what are they going to do? How are they going to recreate the normal excitement that they're able to generate starting, you know, with Black Friday in 2020? And we'll see how it turns out in the next few days, right?
What kind of strategies are you seeing from stores, you know, places with actual physical stores so far to try to negotiate what you're talking about?
Well, you know, for any of the national players or the big players, right, this is less about stores, or at least not as much about stores, as it is the way they blend in the online with the store, right? Because we will not have a Black Friday where the aisles of the stores are overcrowded, where there's no room to move, where people are grabbing for scarce items. It simply won't look like that. So the big thing is how will online be used? How will they connect it to stores with things like curbside pickup? And will they be able to generate the same kind of excitement?
We talked earlier this year, Hart, during the pandemic, about more people turning to online purchases, maybe people who aren't usually the demographic who would do that. Do you think that's something we're going to see a lot of during holiday purchasing?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Depending on the data you look at, you know, I think one survey I saw recently suggested that upwards of 45% of shoppers intend to carry out a majority of their holiday shopping online this year. That's quite that's a big increase over past years, and of course it reflects the fact that it's a lot more work to go to stores. It's a lot less fun than it used to be, but it also reflects the fact that retailers every holiday season are getting better at using apps, using websites to engage consumers.
For the parts of shopping that are still going to be in-store, as you said, it's not going to be those crowded, everybody rushing in the door when they open up early on Black Friday or on Thanksgiving, for that matter. How are stores trying to sell themselves as safe experiences this year for those customers who do want to come in and browse a little bit, hopefully in a not too crowded store?
You know, most retailers for the last since we started allowing retailers to reopen, most of them have clearly posted capacity limits for their stores. Most of them have someone at the front to make sure people are coming in wearing masks. Most of them have stations where you can clean your hands, etc. I think, you know, in when the reopening first happened, they were actually counting customers to make sure they didn't go over those capacity limits. That's been relaxed of late. But of course, with the current upswing in COVID cases, you know, Walmart has announced that they will go back to counting and limiting the number of people in their stores. And, you know, I think this opens up an opportunity, right? You know, from how do you deal with lines that might emerge? How do you keep customers engaged in line with your brand, with your store, so they don't leave to go somewhere else? So this is all possible. The other thing you mentioned was opening on Thanksgiving, and I think that's gone this year. I think most of the big national retailers will be closed on Thanksgiving for the first time in a long time. That list includes Walmart, Target, Kohl's, Bed Bath & Beyond, Best Buy. They're all closing for Thanksgiving this year.
We're talking to Hart Posen from the UW School of Business, looking at how the pandemic has affected holiday shopping this year. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are you doing differently this year? Are you usually a Black Friday customer? How are you changing things up? Have you made a switch to online? Are you trying to support local businesses, maybe with a curbside pickup? Do you run a store? Do you own a store or work at a retail store? What's happening at your location? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's take a step back. Hart, retail is a big business. It employs a lot of people. How important is this holiday season to the year-end balance for retail stores?
It's super important. You can't say that. You can't say that enough. You know, the history of the language, right? Black Friday, in the way it's used now, is usually meant to at least symbolize the end of the part of the year in which businesses are in the red, which in an accounting sense represents a loss, and move into the black, which is a profit. And clearly for many retailers, but not all, this has been a very, very challenging year. And so, you know, I think what we've seen is that consumer spending in the U.S. has been reasonably resilient during COVID. But this year, more than ever, this time is important to them.
I've seen some analysis, Hart, suggesting that we're going to maybe be buying different stuff than we usually do. Maybe because people aren't traveling, they're going to put their money into things around the house. If it's for the kids, things that are going to keep kids entertained for a long time, maybe some willingness to spend a little more on things like that. But those little things you might pick up while browsing a store might take a hit. What are you watching for the choices people are making and what they buy?
You're absolutely right. With travel down substantially from prior years, and particularly sort of the discretionary travel, the holiday travel, this shifts actually some buying power away from travel and to other things. And that might be a new television. It might be things to make the household experience better, warmer, more entertaining. I also think that it's likely, you know, your comment suggested it's likely to hit those kinds of retailers that rely on us coming in for one thing and picking up something else. And I think this is exactly right. And, you know, the best online retailers have tried to recreate that in their app. You know, you go to the Amazon app and they're always making suggestions, not just, you know, to try and engage interest in other products that you might not have come to look for. And some retailers online are getting very, very good at this, but not everyone is. You know, I think the other part of it is the way we shop for Christmas I think, changes as it moves online. You know, gone now, at least for this year, the day where you go to the mall or you go to the store and you walk around to see what, to find what your, you know, what might be interesting, mm-hmm. to discover something. And that discovery is much harder to do now.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to, my memory kind of clicked, and it seems like at least last year and maybe even the year before, they had Black Fridays a week or maybe even 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, especially at places like Menards and those type of home improvement stores, because along with retail stores, because they last year were not anticipating a large profit margin, and so they would start it early for the same reason that now they're going to do it this year. I mean, it's almost like Christmas in July.
Cyril, thanks a lot for that call. There has been that kind of, I guess, mission creep heart where people are like, well, maybe if I get in before Black Friday, my store gets in before Black Friday, we could tap into some of the sales. Have we seen hints of this in years past, as Cyril says?
Absolutely. You know, we've seen the start date for holiday sales moving earlier and earlier every year. You know, even this notion of Black Friday, though, is itself not that old, at least in its modern sense, right? We don't really start to think of it in its modern sense till the 80s and 90s. And then we've seen a steady progression to earlier and earlier opening times for Black Friday, then staying open on Thanksgiving itself, and then sales moving, creeping up earlier than Thanksgiving. You know, we tend to see this as retail competition gets tougher. Firms feel the need to get out ahead, particularly these days. You know, there's sort of this tension between those firms that are really good at doing online kinds of things and those firms that still depend more heavily on brick and mortar alone, whose online experience isn't nearly as positive. Those folks really have to struggle to get you off your sofa and out of your house today to get you into the store. It's unlikely that's going to stop.
Thanks for that call, Cyril. We're talking to Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business, looking at Black Friday sales and how they're looking much different this year. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is looking different in your holiday shopping plans? Are you switching from in-store to online or shopping stores but doing curbside? Have you already done a lot of your holiday shopping? What kinds of things are sounding like good gifts to you this year? What questions do you have about all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Hart Posen, professor at the UW School of Business, looking at how Black Friday is changing this year and maybe permanently in the future. We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. What is different about your holiday shopping this year, if anything? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to our callers now. Katie is with us in Burlington. Katie, hi.
Hi. You know, when you first started this conversation, I thought about calling in and I was going to say, well, we're not going to buy anything. We're giving money to charity this year. But now I'm feeling guilty about that. I thought I was doing the right thing. But and what I've been doing during this pandemic is, like, if I go to a restaurant and do carryout, I give them a really big tip. You know, just trying to do it that way. We go out to we get stuff more. Mm-hmm. But and it's not that I've stopped buying stuff. But I'm not spending as much money, and I can't just buy stuff for the sake of buying it. We don't need anything, so that's
Katie,
a tough one. I want to support them, but
I gotcha, Katie. Thanks a lot for calling in, and I don't think you need to feel guilty about giving to charity at all. But Hart, do we see consumers like Katie rethinking their priorities in this weird year? Maybe thinking, I don't need this stuff. Maybe I'll give to a needy cause in this time of indeed great need.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. The, you know, Katie, you know, said she, when she goes someplace and picks up pizza, she leaves a you know, a bigger tip than she would ever have left in the past. And I'm with her. We do very similar things. I do think it has us rethinking our priorities. And, you know, I think hopefully those of us who can afford to are, in fact, giving more to charity. At the same time, our economy depends, is so dependent on retail sales and consumer demand that not to make it sound as if you're doing your part for the economy by consuming, but when you buy pizza from a local pizza restaurant, you are doing something for the economy in a very important sense.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Hannah now in Madison. Hannah, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add a comment to the conversation about retail workers for large corporations specifically, and how, you know, COVID, like the previous caller said, having us shift our priorities, and how it essentially took a pandemic. It likely to see workers have holidays off, retail workers specifically. You know, so many of them are forced to work through the night without extra pay, without an option of taking the day off. And so this might be the first time ever for a lot of them in their work life that they can actually spend time not working on a holiday.
Hannah, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, Hart, can you talk about the impact on workers at stores maybe having that Thanksgiving off and not having to work the crazy overnight shifts around Black Friday?
Well, I'm sure there's still going to be some overnight shifts, but sure. You're right. The big players like Walmart, Target, Kohl's are not going to open on Thanksgiving. Now, you know, I think this is the right thing to do for workers. It's not clear to me that that's why the big retailers are necessarily doing it, but I do think it has this this side benefit. But, you know, there is the bigger question of sort of the bargaining power and ability of workers in that context to demand better wages and better working conditions. This is a broader question, and clearly their ability to bargain has declined over the last couple of decades. But I think COVID has made the challenges of being in that position much more salient to many of us. And I think that's important.
Hannah, thanks for the call. Tom joins us next in Buffalo County. Tom, hi.
Hello. Yeah, my concern, or what I was thinking about, is I live in a small town, and we have gift shops, you know, these small gift shops that operate in almost every small town throughout Wisconsin. And I just see them as really being going to have a tough time this year. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Hart, what do you think? The small gift stores around the state.
Yeah, you know, this is exactly right. Many of these businesses were having a tough time as it was before COVID, right? You know, what we've come to think about is retail these days, big retail, figuring out how to use online and in-store in a complementary manner to really keep us engaged. And, you know, a small mom-and-pop gift store in a small town neither has the resources nor capabilities to engage in that way. I guess the question they need to think about as small retailers, and we want to keep them, right? We want to keep those in our downtowns. It is, what can they do that is different from what the Targets are doing, or the Kohl's are doing, or the others are doing? They provide a very different service. And thinking about that, I think, would help. You know, I think about how many small businesses responded to COVID in general. Some responded so positively. They were so aggressive in how they managed to change what they did to continue to serve their customers, and others that didn't. And so, you know, at least in part, some of the outcome that we'll observe will be a function of those who were able to try and change as a consequence.
Thanks a lot for that call. Hart, I want to look to the future now. And we've talked before about, you know, with the rise of Amazon, what's the future of brick and mortar in-store retail, or hybrid in-store and online? Now there's COVID sending a lot more people online. What are you watching for with the future? Are we going to, in a hopefully soon post-COVID era, want to rush back into stores?
Oh, you know, I think one of the most striking things about the last, I don't even know how many months is it now? 7, 8 months.
Yeah.
Is our tremendous desire to want to go to stores, not just to buy, but because it is a social and community thing that we want to be there. You know, I remember when in Madison, when Costco reopened after the shutdown, and simply going there, we didn't talk to anybody, but just simply going there and shopping with others around, there is tremendous pleasure we get from that. And it's easy to forget that we actually want that. You know, I always think about, why do we go to restaurants when we could always have gotten takeout? We go to restaurants because we like the social environment. And for me, COVID has made that so salient. And my hope is that particularly the smaller retailers, the local restaurants, understand that and figure out how to capitalize on the fact that we really do want to go and engage socially in these contexts.
Hart, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully we'll get to see each other in person in the studio at some point.
Yes, we'll have that social connection again, Hart. Good to talk to you.
We will.
That was Hart Posen, Professor of Management and Human Resources at the UW School of Business. He joined us today to talk about COVID-19 and how it's making retailers rethink Black Friday and holiday shopping, and how they're going to market holiday shopping in the future. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Let us know how you are shopping. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org if you own or work in one of those smaller retail stores around the state. Love to hear how you're doing. Share your story. Email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to Chef Dan Kluger about his new cookbook, Chasing Flavor. He's got a lot of great suggestions to up our kitchen game. I've already learned a few new things. Got a little shopping list going, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a specialist in infectious disease about the best ways to stay safe over the Thanksgiving holiday. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if you're a home cook and have been looking to expand your kitchen skills, we have the Food Friday for you. This week, we talked to a chef to learn about how to incorporate restaurant techniques in a home kitchen and how to find inspiration in some new flavors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a fancy technique or one that seems fancy anyway that you've learned to use in your home kitchen? How does it work? What does it do for your food? Are you in need of some help? Do you have some questions for a guest in order to help you take more culinary risks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan Kluger is a chef and the owner of Loring Place in New York City. He's the author of the cookbook, Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write in Chasing Flavor that you're inspired in part to write this because you get asked a lot, how do I make this at home? And you wanted to find ways that actual, you know, real life kitchen cooks can at least capture some of that restaurant essence. How hard is it to translate what you do in a restaurant kitchen into our home kitchens?
I think that, you know, the idea with the book is to try and break down a little bit of that mystique that it's really that different. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of skill that goes into what we do, but a lot of what we do is build a great pantry and a great pantry of staples that can be used to elevate simple dishes and learning some simple techniques to elevate flavor. I'm not going to say that's exactly the same as eating in the restaurant. If I say that, nobody's going to come to the restaurant anymore. But there is the way to kind of break down that barrier a little bit, make people feel more confident. And that was the goal in the book.
And what I like about the book is, I mean, you've got recipes, but the message isn't follow these recipes to the letter or else. It's each recipe gives a technique that you, or a, an ingredient or a pre-made ingredient that you can take from that recipe and then use in your other cooking. Why was it important to you to communicate not just the recipes, but the techniques that we can learn from them?
Because you can build flavor through something as simple as roasting a vegetable properly. And that could be roasting it where it gets some char on it, or roasting it on a rack where it actually starts to dry up a little bit and become more intense in flavor. So something as simple as techniques like that can make a difference in, again, really simple dishes. I mean, my kids never really liked steamed vegetables, but they love roasted vegetables. And so I think as soon as you start to change a little bit of the flavor of something and make it a little more addictive, it's wonderful.
You just happened to key in on one piece of advice from your book that, Dan, I'm going to use probably this weekend. I oven roast vegetables a lot, and I do them right on a pan or in a casserole dish, and they come out fine. But, you know, you got to flip them, and sometimes the ones in this corner get a little burned too early or whatever. You say use, I'm going to do this, I'm going to buy one, a wire rack, a wire baking rack, crisscross, not just the slats going in one way, and oven bake them on that. What is that? It sounds great. What does that do for us?
Right. So by lifting it up out of the pan, you're allowing air to circulate all around it. Whether or not you have a convection oven, you're still allowing air to circulate all the way around the vegetables or whatever you're cooking. So the wire rack can make a huge difference in how you roast things. You still have to watch out for the ones in the corners, et cetera. But if you took something like a butternut squash, and we do a recipe in the book that has this, but if you took just the butternut squash and you cut it into a 1-inch cube, toss a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and you cook one on a rack and you cook the other batch straight on the tray, you'll notice night and day difference, right? The one on the rack, it becomes what I refer to as sort of raisinated. It's starting to dry up like a raisin. It gets a little more caramelized, gets a little crispy, and it's really intense in butternut flavor. The one that's right on the pan, it's a little more soggy. The top is caramelized, but the bottom is soggy. And so, again, it's little techniques like this that can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time doing the show today because I want to get out there and buy a rack just like this and start using it right away. I love this. Talking to Dan Kluger, chef in New York City. His new cookbook is Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. Now, Dan, you shared a few recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You just mentioned squash. Here's a recipe. I like this. Roasted acorn squash, okay, with spicy granola and apple gastrique. Tell us about this recipe.
Yeah, so this is a great example of the section in the book that we call takeaways, and every recipe has a takeaway, and that's something that I want you to learn from it. And it could be a technique, or it could be the sauce, or in this case, it could be something like the granola. And so we sort of simply roast acorn squash, you know, pretty, I don't want to say mundane vegetable, but not the most exciting vegetable. It is a little bit sweet. So we then balance that out with the sweet and sour gastrique, which is literally sweet and sour. That's what gastrique means. And it's got some apple cider and cider vinegar, and that's drizzled on. And then we make this sweet and spicy granola. So it has a ton of texture. So you have soft squash and this granola that it's more of a savory granola. It has ginger, it has chilies, it has smoked paprika. And again, that's something that we want people to use to build their pantry. You can use this granola on that. You could use it on butternut squash. You could use it on potatoes. You could sprinkle it on a salad. Some people I know have even been using it for their breakfast with yogurt. So, again, it's about learning some simple techniques and simple recipes that help you build a pantry and become more confident to mix and match and create exciting food.
I love that idea. You call it component cooking in the book, where that granola is one example, or you know, you might pickle some onions or carrots for one dish and then use them tomorrow in a salad or something. You might make a vinaigrette for a sauce and then use it as a salad dressing the next day. That idea that the effort we put in for a part of this meal, then we can hold it extra over and use it in something completely different. I love that. Talk about how that gives us some flexibility.
Sure. So, I mean, again, you know, you're not going to necessarily get this by opening the book and picking out your two favorite recipes. You need to read through it, you know, cook at it, get used to it, and start to see that the dressing from the chicory salad on page whatever it is, 130, can also really work well with some roasted chicken and some arugula. And the reason being is, you know, in the food, we want lots of sweet and sour and spicy. We want a little bitter. We want crunchy. We want all these elements that we refer to as peaks and valleys. And in order to get these peaks and valleys, it's, again, about building this pantry and feeling comfortable that if you're going for, again, trying to create this balance, these sweet and sour components, well, you have a great vinaigrette. So why not use that again? You don't have to necessarily make the vinaigrette for the chicken salad on page 200. The one you made on 190, that worked really well. So that's what I think, you know, the goal is. And I think it sounds maybe easier said than done, but as people start to cook through it, they'll see it. And you know, to your original point about why I wrote the book, I have people come to me all the time and say, you know, this broccoli is amazing, or these butternut squash fries are incredible. How do you make this sauce? And I tell them, and first of all, they're blown away how simple it is, but then they say, well, I want to use this on everything. And that's the point is, you know, a lot of these things, not everything, but a lot of these things can be used in multiple ways. And something like the lemon parmesan aioli from the butternut squash fries also works really well with pasta. It works well with pizza. I cook fairly simply at home because my kids don't love a ton of sauces, but I always have one of these things, a condiment or a sauce or something like that, that I can then spoon on simply roasted chicken or some plain fish.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Phil is with us in Verona. Phil, hello.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What are you up to, Phil?
Well, actually, I had a question. Traditionally, I sous vide chicken breasts every week for, you know, salads and things like that. I was hoping to integrate maybe my immersion circulator for the turkey this year for Thanksgiving. And I guess I'm just curious how I can get the most flavor into it, either by doing something before or after it's been through its cook time.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. I think you mentioned in the book using sous vide for poached eggs, Dad, but do you have any thoughts for Phil doing that technique for turkey? And remind us what sous vide is, because I always it's not something I do myself.
Sure. So sous vide cooking is essentially cooking in a bag with no oxygen at a specific temperature water. So you submerge the bag of food or whatever it's going to be into the water at a specific temperature. You're typically cooking low and slow. So that chicken breast that you cook comes out incredibly tender and juicy. It doesn't lose a lot of its moisture. The using that for turkey is probably one of the best things you could do this Thanksgiving. It is incredibly beneficial to cooking turkey. I think when I do it, and I typically do it, I'll just throw a little bit of butter and some herbs and garlic in the bag, seal it up, and I'll cook the turkey, take it out, pat it dry, put it skin side down in a nonstick pan over medium heat and kind of crisp up that skin, and then I'll just baste it with some butter and some herbs again. You can go that route. You could make a paste of herbs and garlic and stick it into the bag under the skin and cook it. But either way, that, you know, the goal is that you're cooking it slow and low. And in my mind, the goal is that you're then going to use the skin either separately or on top and crisp it up to bring in that texture.
Phil, hope that helps. Thanks for calling in. We're talking to Chef Dan Kluger right now for this week's edition of Food Friday. His new cookbook is Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. We've got a few of those recipes with the techniques attached to them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how to learn something from restaurant style cooking in your own kitchen? And have you found techniques that you've been able to apply not just to that one recipe, but you can learn from this and apply it to that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Chef Dan Kluger, owner of New York City's Loring Place. His new cookbook is called Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice on tackling a particular technique in the kitchen? What kind of flavors are you interested in trying out? Or if you have something yourself that's really helped you cook that you want to share, join in, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to ask about, Rebecca?
You were talking a little bit ago about roasting vegetables and the difference between them being directly on the pan where they're a little more soggy and elevated with a rack where they're a little bit more crispy, and I think you said like raisin-like or something like that. So I'm wondering, can you use those wire cooling racks? They're just plain metal wire cooling racks that you use for like putting cookies or cakes on after they come out of the oven. Can you just put one of those in a pan, or do you need a special rack thing?
Rebecca, does it have wires just going in one direction, the one you have, or both directions, kind of squares?
Both.
Okay, so that's good news, Dan. But are all of those necessarily oven safe?
They should be. I mean, if it's aluminum or stainless, it should be. I don't know of any cooling racks really that wouldn't be made for that. And as long as it's got the wires going both directions like you asked, it should be just fine.
Fantastic. Rebecca, thanks for calling, and thanks for making it clear that I'm not the only one excited about this idea. Back to your calls now. Shannon is with us in Milwaukee. Shannon, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Shannon?
So I've been looking into kind of incorporating more whole spices into my cooking, like Sichuan peppercorns and things like that. But there's a lot of information about using like an electric spice grinder or a mortar and pestle. And I was just wondering if there was a suggestion about what's the best tool to use. And if it's a mortar and pestle, what type I should be using. I'm looking for something that's pretty broad range that can just be used for everyday cooking.
All right. Great question. I have an old coffee grinder I use for spices, Dan, but what do you recommend for when we want to take those, you know, cumin seeds and things like that and get a lot of flavor out of them?
Yeah, it kind of depends on what you're making and what the end result is supposed to be. Most of the time, I want finely ground. Once in a while, I want something like coriander seed that might just be kind of crushed and add some texture. You can use a mortar and pestle if you're going to. I would look for sort of like a simple ceramic one, stone one, something that's not too coarse so that you're not ending up with lots of crevices that get filled with the food and then you're trying to get it out. I think they're great for making, again, kind of coarse marinades where you don't want it to be too smooth. But in general, with the spices, I use a coffee grinder just like you, simple, you know, Braun coffee grinder. It can hold up to about a cup of spices. And if I'm going for coarse, I just pulse it a few times, you know, tap the top. But I worked in an Indian-inspired restaurant with the late, great Floyd Cardoz for about 7 years. And we used electric grinders, whether it was coarse or whole. And I'm a huge fan of those.
Thanks for that call, Shannon. I should say I was inspired to start grinding my own spices by having Floyd Cardoz on a Food Friday episode a bunch of years back. And it's huge. It makes a big difference. And Dan, that issue reminds me of something else I read in your book, something I'm guilty of with herbs in things. And I chop my herbs, and you say, no, go easy on that. Why?
One time through. You always hear me screaming at the cooks in the kitchen, one time through. My belief, with the exception of essentially parsley, which can kind of, you know, you can kind of take a little more, but in general, you want to go one time through your herbs, no matter how fine you're going for them, because the more you chop it, the more you're releasing those natural oils into your cutting board. And, you know, cooks will always challenge me on that, and I will show them that their cutting board is now bright green and the oil's getting smeared into it. And so if you want to go for a really finely chopped something, it takes knife skills, it takes getting used to it, but you can bunch up real small and go really fine. If you wanted to do it one more time through, fine. But the people that are going back and forth, rocking their knife over it, you're bruising those herbs, you're releasing those oils into the cutting board rather than the food.
Guilty as charged. We're talking to Dan Kluger. His new book is Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. Hey, let's check out another recipe you shared with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Oh, you mentioned pizza earlier. Let's do that one. Brussels sprout pizza with pickled chilies and, we're in Wisconsin, we love this part, cheddar. Tell us about this pizza.
So we make a whole wheat pizza dough, which has a ton of flavor to it. Our pizzas are less the, you know, classic margarita. They're more like this. They have not necessarily a ton going on, but they're less classic and a little more involved. So this one has a little bit of ricotta. We make our own ricotta. I think there's even a recipe in the book for how to make ricotta. It's a simple task, a lot of fun. And then we take the outer leaves of Brussels sprouts. We blanch them really quick so they have a little bit of moisture in them and they're more or less cooked. This will allow them to finish cooking in the oven and not dry out and get totally crisp like we were talking about earlier. Something like this pizza, you don't want just a bunch of crisp leaves. And so we squeeze those out, lay them on top. We make a little garlic oil, sprinkle that on. And then we finish it with some cheddar and pickled jalapenos and a little bit of lemon zest. And that goes back to what I was talking about in terms of balance, right? You have something that's kind of rich now with the cheese, and it's finished with a little bit of acid from the pickles and the lemon, and it's also finished with a little bit of spice, and that just balances the food out. And again, you may say, I don't like heat. That's fine. What I want you to get from it is that you need a little bit of acid to balance this out. So if you don't want to do pickled chilies, hit it with a little splash of vinegar or squeeze a lemon. Adding that acid in is one of these techniques that builds flavor and makes the food that much more interesting.
Now this one, you got to be a little premeditated here. You got to make the dough and let it sit for 12 hours. This is one of those things that you talk about learning from restaurants. You can do a lot of your work in advance with components, like in this case, the pizza dough. Should we change our mindset to, like, you know, have that stuff done when we have time in advance so that we're not doing everything at once when we're trying to cook dinner?
Yeah, so I mean, I would say two things. One, in terms of the pizza, this goes back to things that we talk about in the book in terms of, look, we're telling you how to make pizza dough and we want you to make pizza dough. If you don't want to make the pizza dough, no problem. Use store-bought dough, use a shell, do whatever you need to do, but at least incorporate this balance of flavor that we're trying to teach people. To the other point about getting ahead, a lot of the recipes talk about that. You know, the restaurant, again, you talk about the mystique of a restaurant. Most restaurants, they're not cooking everything for you right at that minute. The vegetables were blanched. The sauce was made. Things were already chopped. We're finishing it, what we call a la minute. And so we're teaching you through these recipes, and we point out places where you can do something in advance. You can get something a day or two done, get something done a day or two in advance, set it aside, wrap it up, and now you're ready to cook. And all you have to do is pull that acorn squash out, warm it up, drizzle it with the glaze, throw the granola on, and boom, you have this amazing dish. And you only had to be in the kitchen with your guests in the house for 10 minutes. But you spent, you know, an hour the day before. So there's a lot that can be done, and that's something that we try and teach through this book as well.
Great place to leave it. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's Dan Kluger, chef and owner of Loring Place in New York City. He joined us for this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about his new cookbook. It's called Chasing Flavor, Techniques and Recipes to Cook Fearlessly. You can check out a few recipes we talked about today and one we didn't actually at WPR.org/Food Friday. Head over there and find that Brussels sprouts pizza with pickled chilies and cheddar. Crust recipe, you can use it or use a store-bought crust if you want. Roasted acorn squash with spicy granola and apple gastrique. And roast chicken on a bed of vegetables. Again, all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the Trump administration has set a timetable to remove more American troops from Afghanistan. We'll get the latest on the move and reaction from Congress. Plus, we'll find out about the psychological benefits of repeating fun experiences. That and more Monday on Central Time. The holiday season means holiday TV specials, but at one point it looked like a time-honored classic might not be on the airwaves. The Peanuts TV specials, including Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, went to the Apple Plus streaming service. We mentioned that a while back. Some good news for fans. There is a chance to watch them the old-fashioned way. Producer Bill Martins is with us. What's happening, Bill?
Hey, Rob. So, yeah, this came out, I think, last month or so, that Apple TV Plus was going to be the exclusive home for all things Peanuts. And, of course, that includes the three holiday cartoons at the end of the year. Well, this packed a lot of people off. And so there was actually a change.org petition that got going around. I looked at it just now. It's been signed by more than 263,000 people to bring the Peanuts cartoons back on broadcast TV. So earlier this week, PBS came out and said, hey, guess what? We reached a deal with Apple, and now we're going to air a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving and a Charlie Brown Christmas on stations across the country, including PBS Wisconsin. So people are going to get to see it on broadcast TV after all.
And do we know, did I see it was this Sunday evening? It was going to be on PBS here in Wisconsin, the Thanksgiving special?
Right. The Thanksgiving special is going to air Sunday at 6:30 p.m. And then the Christmas one will be on Sunday, December 13th. I'm assuming that'll also be at 6:30.
We'll fire up the popcorn maker for traditional Charlie Brown Thanksgiving dinner. Bill, thanks a lot.
Yes, sir.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.